What you have here is a lecture about 16th and 17th century religious conflict. It's three different sections, one on Germany, one on France, and the last one is on England. 2 weeks ago, Garrett gave a lengthy lecture on Reformation in England, including these notes. So it's the same subject matter. I just thought I'd give you these notes for your collection if you'd like them. We're going to primarily talk about Germany and France tonight. Realizing the first part of this little section on Germany is going to go back into the 16th century, but really where we are in the scope of history is we're moving into the 17th century. The 16th century, or the 1500s, is a little overpowering. Todd, you still back there? Can you turn me down just a little? Yeah, thanks. The 16th century is Reformation century. The 16th century, early 1500s is Martin Luther. And so that century really was, historians will talk about the two major cataclysms, if you will, in the history of Christianity. One of them being the Reformation, the other one being, anybody know? What's that? No. The second one was the discovery of the New World. Obviously it's a big part of our history, but for the spread of Christianity, you think about Spain kind of, you know, took over many of the Caribbean islands and Mexico and Central America. Basically anywhere today that speaks Spanish was colonized by Spain, and with it not only came the Spanish language, but Spanish Catholicism. The few islands that spoke French were brought there by French, who not only brought their language, but also French Catholicism. And of course, the places where English are spoken were, you know, not only brought the English language, but many of the English Anglican religion, as we'll see next week or later on, Puritan religion, and a variety of other Protestant strains. And so the discovery of the New World, and really for the last 200 years, 300 years, the center of Christianity has been the Americas. And so, which was a bigger effect on the history of the church, the Protestant Reformation or the discovery of the New World? That's an interesting question to think about. Yeah, I mean, who knows? It's probably both, or both in tandem, but what we read about in the 1500s is how much struggle there was for Protestantism to gain a foothold because of the control of the Roman Catholic Church. And as we move into the 17th century, it's marked by wars, but those wars were fought by whom? It's Catholics and Protestants fighting each other over rights to practice their religion however they chose. And so Protestantism, I mean, it spread and it grew and it developed in Europe, but the New World, particularly the colonies here in the U.S., created an environment where Protestant Christianity could grow and flourish freely without the opposition of the Roman Catholic Church to the extent that it existed in Europe. And so 1500s, that's the two big points. Protestant Reformation, Martin Luther, John Calvin, Ulrich Zwingli, the three big names, and the discovery of the New World. We move into the 17th century, really a big shift. Protestant religions are in place. In Europe, Lutheranism was entrenched. Reformed Christianity, the product of Calvin and Zwingli, was entrenched. You talked 2 or 3 weeks ago about the Anabaptists, predominantly growing in Holland, in the Dutch settlements, a little bit in Germany. But you've got, these are no longer fighting for a place. They exist. They have lots of people. Switzerland, of course, lots of Protestant Christianity in Switzerland. Now what they're doing is just this constant argument over freedom of religion, really. In the 1500s and moving on to the next couple of centuries, it was generally assumed that for a nation to be united politically, it also needed to be united religiously. And so this is why the kings, the emperors, wax and wane on dabbling in religion. If we're going to be a united France, then we have to be united in our Catholicism. Or if we're going to be united Germany, then we have to be united in our religion. And today we might sometimes think of Protestantism and Catholicism as different traditions of the same religion. But back then, it didn't work that way. They viewed them as separate branches. And so it's an interesting thought, because these wars that are going to happen in the 17th century are going to begin kind of dulling people's sensitivities towards religion. And they're going to begin the process that's kind of led Europe to where it is today, where people are not, they're not heretics so much as they are just apathetic towards religion. Religion caused so many wars and bloodshed and death that people began to grow more and more tolerant of one another in Europe. We would like to think that that tolerance emerged out of an understanding of Christ's love for them and their love for others. That's not what happened. Their tolerance started growing out of just general apathy. We just don't care anymore. And at that point, we're practicing religion, but we really don't care about, you know, tradition, about boundaries. And that would that sense of apathy would lead to a place where now we just don't care about religion at all. How do you see, I mean, I'm not asking for an answer, but just for you to think about, can a country be united politically but not identical religiously? That is the question. The secular state would begin rising up after these 17th century, the 30 Years' War, some of the religious infighting in France, and all of a sudden people would think about having a German government, a French government, an English government that is a secular state, not a religious state. And obviously, you know, our Constitution has been built that we are one nation under God, but that people that live in this country have the freedom to practice their religion as they choose, as long as it doesn't infringe on the rights or well-being of someone else. And so we continue living in the laboratory of this experiment. Can we be united politically even if we are not identical religiously? The last chapter probably has not been written on that. But I think you see in our country, many people would want to say, yes, we can. We tend to be interacting with the Muslim world, the Hindu world, the Buddhist world, where in many of those contexts, their answer is still the same as Christian answers were back in the 15 and 1600s. They believe that you cannot, that for us to be politically unified, militarily strong, to hold our place in the global economy, we must also be religiously united. And so to change from one world religion to another, to shift from one of these other religions to Christianity, is not only viewed as perhaps abandoning one's faith, but it's also in some sense viewed as a sort of being a traitor to one's own country. It carries political, patriotic undertones. And I think as Americans, we often don't get that, because it's not that way for us. We don't understand how the two go together in many other parts of the world. But it wasn't that long ago that in our religion, it was exactly the same way. And so the Catholic Church would march into Protestant cities and force Protestants to renounce their Protestant doctrines and reunite with the Catholic Church. And if they wouldn't, they would execute them. Well, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? Yeah. So that kind of stuff's going on today. Just not, you know, the names of the religions have changed and the people playing their parts have changed, but the philosophy is much the same. Return to Catholicism. If you don't, we'll execute you. In fact, you're going to see, if you read through the chapters, it talked about how in Germany, during the 30 Years' War, whenever the Catholic Church would go into a Protestant environment, if they were able to siege and then ultimately conquer a city, Protestants who would not reunite with the Catholic Church, men were sent to row in galleys on ships trading. Women were put in prison for life. Pastors were executed, and their children were put into the foster care system and adopted by good Catholic families so they would be raised as good Catholics. Interesting, right? A lot of the things we see today, they're not brand new. They've been practiced before, and they've been practiced by so-called Christians. Thus is the challenge, though, in us trying to live and represent the love of Christ today, is our history is full of examples of people living and serving and exemplifying the love and mercy of Jesus Christ. But it's also full of what Jesus would call, in the eschatological sermon before Passion Week, wolves dressed like sheep. That there will always be people claiming to represent the church, claiming to represent God, but really only existing to serve their own personal agendas and personal gain. And for people on the outside of the church trying to discern, how can you distinguish between the two? Or can you? You simply take all of it as a whole and you look at the history of Christianity or religion as a whole, and people who claim that religion is only good for causing wars and making people hate one another have plenty of evidence to go on. They have plenty of evidence. The problem is that's not the whole story, and it's our responsibility to continue living our lives in such a way that the rest of the story is told. But we have our work cut out for us. So we move into the 17th century. Page one, it starts in Germany, and this is backtracking on some items we'd already talked about. Martin Luther, the Edict of Worms in 1521, the First and Second Diets of Speyer, Peace of Nuremberg, 1532. 4b, this Peace of Nuremberg allowed Protestants to retain their faith, but forbade expansion into new territories. In Germany, in France, whenever military means forced kings to kind of relent, we can't be running all of our Protestant Germans into Switzerland because we need them to fight because there's wars going on. It was usually military reasons that caused them to fudge a little bit on their very spiritual policies. But when they would, even when they would do that, they would say, okay, this city or this county or this city is Protestant, and all of the Protestants have to live in this, these cities or these counties. It was still presumed that governance had to be, people had to be unified, at least in the same city or the same county, in order for civility to exist. That we can't put Catholics and Protestants in the same town, they just won't get along. They'll always be fighting and arguing, and, you know, one won't do business with the other, and the other won't do business with the one, and it just creates this whole problem. So we put all of our Protestants over here, and all of our Catholics over here, and that's going to lead to infighting, civil wars, so to speak, here when another 60, 70 years pass. Religious war, even in the 1500s, we see that. The Treaty of Augsburg in 1555. And then we pick up in the 1600s with the 30 Years' War. How many of you heard of the 30 Years' War? How many of you might not could exactly identify what it was? That's usually me. I know of it. The 30 Years' War predominantly took place in Germany. It started as a civil war within Germany between Protestants and Catholics. But as all of these European countries were tied together, as the war went on, there were other countries who stood to gain from Catholicism and regaining control, and so they would enter on the side of the Catholics. And then there were other countries that stood to gain by Germany being in shambles, and so they would enter on the Protestant side. And there were those who really, you know, cared about Protestantism, Switzerland, Holland being a couple of examples. You see, Rudolf II was emperor of Germany beginning in 1576 until 1606. He was staunchly Catholic, but his policies were pretty laissez-faire. He didn't do much about it. He didn't really push the envelope. Protestant Germans were allowed to stay in their cities and regions. Catholics continued practicing Catholicism. It was no big deal. Upon his death, there was a city, you see Donauwörth, a city on the edge of Bavaria, one of the regions of a very traditional Roman Catholic region of Germany. This city chose to become Protestant in 1606. And when it did, what I just said. There was a monastery there. Monks lived there. When the monks would come out from their monasteries, the Protestants would throw stuff at them and harass them and beat them and run them back to their monastery. If they wanted to practice their religion, they were only able to do so behind the walls of the monastery. And so, you see on C, Duke Maximilian of Bavaria in 1607 marched on the city, forced all residents to reconvert to the Roman Catholic Church. This led to, a couple of years later, 1609, German Protestants forming the Evangelical Union. Roman Catholics formed the Catholic League. And those were basically for the purpose of militarizing oneself, each group, in order to stand against the other. Evangelicals versus Catholics. Rudolf died 1606, I believe. His brother Matthias became emperor. Rudolf died 1612. Matthias appointed his cousin Ferdinand as king. Ferdinand tried rigidly to force Roman Catholicism on his subjects. Not much there that's really bears mentioning. Number four, the war begins in Bohemia. Each side were calling kings that would suit their preference, the Protestants in Germany and the Catholics in Germany. You see in Bohemia, Ferdinand was the Protestant favorite. Maximilian was a Catholic favorite. Danes began to get involved. Does this not have the incident in Prague? It does not. It's generally presumed there was representatives in Prague, which is modern-day Czech Republic, but back then was, what was it back then? Oh, it is, okay. Yes, thank you. I skipped over that. Yeah, Matthias and Ferdinand were absent from Prague. Protestants rebelled against royal advisors, sympathetic to the Catholic Church, threw them out the window. It's referred to as the Defenstration of Prague. Protestants in Prague threw the Catholic royal administrators out the window. It didn't kill them. They landed on a pile of garbage. But that generally is marked as the beginning of the 30 Years' War. 16, didn't give a year. I don't think it was 1612. It was closer to 1618 because the war is going to go to 1648 or 48. You know, if you didn't read about this in the book, you can kind of read through the information there. Lots of stories to be told about the 30-Year War. You see 4B, the Danes come in and intervene. They're on the side of the Protestants. 1625, Protestant League was formed by England, the Netherlands, and Denmark to restore Frederick to the Palatinate. England and France agreed to join expeditions, but France backed out. Italy, of course, heavy Catholics would come in favor of the Germans. And really, for about 15 years, it was just hit and miss, battles, fighting, people come in, people come out, people have political agendas, they come in and fight on one side or the other. And of course, as is the case in most wars, who paid the greatest price during all of this? The German people. I mean, the German people who just wanted to be left at peace, to live their lives and practice their religions, ultimately were the greatest sacrifices of the 30 Years' War. A name that's really important, and oddly enough, Sweden doesn't play a very big role in much of church history. They don't come into the story much, but here during the 30 Years' War, this general named Gustavus Adolphus, financed partly by Cardinal Richelieu of France, we'll come back around to him in the next section, Adolphus put together a Swedish army. They were Protestant, and they marched on Germany. You see a victory over the Roman Catholics at Leipzig in 1631, at Lutzen in 1632. The stories about Adolphus talk about he came in and was predominantly Swedish, didn't have many backers, didn't have many support. But when he would go into towns, he and his army were treating people with kindness, with compassion, with love. They were Protestants, but they weren't forcing Roman Catholics to leave their cities or convert to Protestantism. It's 15 years into the war, we finally have somebody fighting in the war, but acting like Christians, like we would identify, you know, trying to protect people that they identified with, but not doing so at a real harsh cost to those who disagreed with them. From 1630 to 1632, the Swedish army went from being nobody to the Germans rallying around them, even some Catholic Germans rallying around them, Protestants from other countries coming to their aid, and really was a significant force right in the middle of the 30 Years' War. The great military general that the Roman Catholics had used up until this point had never been defeated and had come in and won a lot of battles and then left. With the Swedish army rallying, Maximilian called for this other German general, and I do not remember his name. Here he is, Albert of Wallenstein, I think, or Wallenstein, mentioned at the top of page 206 under number 3. The first time he was defeated was this Battle of Lutzen. It mentioned in 1632. Under C, number 2. The Protestants, this was a decisive victory for the Protestants against the Catholics. The only problem was at that battle, Adolphus was killed on the field of battle. And so, but that really began kind of, if the 30 Years' War escalated for 15 years, and then the Swedes kind of turned the tide, and it began, is de-escalating a word? We're going with it. Began de-escalating after that point. Final skirmishes you see under D, including Sweden, Denmark as well. France invaded Germany. Ultimately, 1648, the Peace of Westphalia was agreed to. This is number 5. Princes were allowed to choose the religion of their territory with 3 options: Roman Catholic, Lutheran, or Reformed. Notice who was not included in the Peace of Westphalia. The Anabaptists. The Anabaptists were still viewed as a subversive group. And so they were, this was freedom of religion, sort of. Only to a certain extent. Yeah, freedom for some. Subjects were allowed to immigrate if they disagreed. If you live in one territory, the prince chooses Roman Catholicism, you can move. The prince chooses Protestantism and you're Catholic, you can move. Ecclesiastical properties, churches, monasteries, reverted to those who owned them in 1624. German states gained more freedom in conducting domestic and foreign affairs. General amnesty for those who had rebelled against their rulers except in the hereditary possessions of the Habsburgs. You see the results. Devastated Germany economically, depleted her human resources, inhibited possibility of a unifying German nation state until the 19th century, contributed to a growing indifference about religion. That's what I was talking about earlier. A growing indifference, futility over the destructive power of religious conflict, and it was obvious that political leaders had used religious issues for merely political purposes. With the printing press, with news, with the world getting smaller, you know, it took longer than it does now, but after decades of fighting and war, people started to wise up, and they started seeing popes and emperors and kings and princes using religion to fight religious wars for reasons that had nothing to do with religion. And people really started getting tired of that, and they began, as people do today, when religion is abused, they started to grow indifferent of religion altogether and didn't want to have anything to do with it. Instead of allowing the abuse of religion to drive them towards the correct practice of religion, people would just start giving up on it altogether. And that really hasn't changed in 400 years, for the most part. I always tell people, if you think about it, if there's a God, and if God's revelation, what we believe to be God's revelation of himself is true, and if there's also a force of evil that stands opposed to God, trying to damage the work of God, this kind of discrediting of one's reputation really is a brilliant strategy, is it not? This is Pharaoh and Moses. Pharaoh telling his people, stop giving them straw, keep the quota the same. The people are going to be working so hard, they're going to be miserable, they're going to hate Moses. We'll discredit them from the inside. And it has been, in fact, if you read Revelation, this is the dragon and his agents, the beast of the earth and the beast of the sea, one who is a religious figure, one who's a political figure, and how they lead people astray by oppressive governmental reign and false religious belief. It's not a single figure, it's recurring figures throughout the history of the Christian church. It's the strategy of the dragon to deceive people and to lead people astray. And we see it throughout the history of the Christian church. We see it in our world today. Comments or thoughts about the 30 Years' War? 30 Years' War is Germany. The Inquisition was in lots of places, but really centered in Spain. Spain, by the way, during the 30 Years' War, heavily invested on the side of the Catholics. England, Switzerland, Sweden invested on the side of the Protestants. But the Habsburg family, part of it was represented in Spain, and Spain was incredibly powerful then, incredibly wealthy, and threw lots of resources and energy and military power behind the Catholic endeavors in the 30 Years' War. And so it started out as a civil war within Germany, and then it became, not world war, but I mean practically all of European war, including at least Western Europe, but it even included Austria, included as far as Prague. So 30 Years' War, Germany. We moved to France during the same time period. France didn't have anything quite as dramatic as the 30 Years' War, but the dynamic was much the same. France was a heavily Catholic country that had given fortified cities to Protestants in order to combat a lot of what was going on in the 16th century, the previous 100 years. Some of that background information is in A, Gallicanism, next page, Francis I. If you don't recall, if you look at 2F, the Waldenses, that was kind of the primary Protestant group in France during this time period. France, by the way, Protestants came to be given a separate French name. Sometimes you'll hear them referred to as the Huguenots. Huguenot is just a French term to refer to Protestants, anybody who was Protestant, non-Catholic, during the early years of Reformation. And that is significant in some regards. My mother's family, as far back as they can trace my ancestors on my mom's side, they immigrated to the U.S. in the 1600s from England. Their name is presumed to be French, and it is assumed that they fled France as Huguenots amidst religious persecution by the Catholic Church and came to. You'll see, I don't know if it's in the notes, I know it's in the book, it talked about during that time period that a lot of Protestants in France spread out everywhere. I mean, whenever they were forced to leave, they went to England, they went to Holland, they went to Switzerland, some went to Germany, they went to North America, they went as far away as Russia. And it stripped France of a lot of its artisans, a lot of its farmers, a lot of its people resources, which is going to then begin creating some philosophy and thinking that's going to lead directly. Many historians feel like this religious battle between Catholics and Protestants and the emigration of Protestants out of the country would lead to the French Revolution of the 1800s. So we go to Les Miserables and all that's going on there, that would be a byproduct of what was going on spiritually, religiously, in the 1600s. Religious persecution and war under Henry II, Francis II, Charles IX. You see religious wars. Huguenots forced to take up arms on page 208. The St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre in 1572. Bringing us to struggle for power on C. Henry III became king after Charles IX. He had no heir, so Henry Bourbon was next in the bloodline. We had this long war of the three Henrys. Actually, that's the previous century as well. Number four, Henry Bourbon would become King Henry IV. And he would be the king moving into the 17th century. Drew support from England, Netherlands, and Germany. Converted to Roman Catholicism. Henry IV is known for jumping back and forth. He would be Catholic or Protestant depending on which one suited his military purposes this year. And if now he's Catholic, and next year he might be Protestant, and he'll be there 3 or 4 years, and then he's Catholic again. And it was kind of an ongoing joke in the country. But in 1598, you see this on D, he issued the Edict of Nantes. That's a very important document for the French people. The same as the Treaty of Nuremberg was in Germany, the Edict of Nantes was a document declaring religious freedom for Protestants in France. And it would stay in place for a while, but definitely not permanent. You see, granted Huguenots freedom of worship in all places where they'd possessed churches, allowed them to keep their fortified towns they'd held in 1597. Henry IV was assassinated by a Catholic extremist who, of course, didn't like this in 1610, and thus begins religious battles in France. Henry's son would be the next king, but he was 8 years old when Henry died. And so the wife of Henry IV, Marie de Medici, would kind of take the face of political power, but the cardinal of the Roman Catholic Church, Cardinal Richelieu, would be the acting king until the son became of age. And Richelieu is who we mentioned a while ago in the 30 Years' War. Richelieu was the perfect example of the guy who did not care anything about religion spiritually, but would use religion to serve his political purpose in whatever way it benefited him. And so, because it served his purpose for Germany to be all discombobulated, whenever the Habsburgs start sending Spanish support to the Catholics, Richelieu starts sending money covertly to fund Danes and Dutch Protestants to come to the aid of the German Protestants. In his own country, however, he felt like it was a problem that you had these outstanding Protestant fortified cities that someday might rise up and rebel against the larger government of France. And so while he's supporting Protestants in Germany, he is making war against Protestants in his own country. Political purposes. That was all he was doing. In fact, they would march on cities, siege them, force people to convert. But once they kind of took back all the fortified cities from the French Protestants, he signed he reverted back to the Edict of Nantes and allowed people to practice their religion however they wanted. He didn't care what religion people were practicing. He just cared that there were holdout cities that might rebel against the French government at some point. And so once the fortified cities were taken away, you can go back to being Protestant if you want. I don't care. It was kind of his attitude. Most of that's probably worded a little bit better there. Number four, you see his policies. Support of the Protestants in the 30 Years' War. Centralized power in the French crown. He stripped the Huguenots of their power as they might effectively rebel. Attacked and defeated their fortified towns. After this, issued them a toleration in religious and civil matters. He would be in power, and I think until his death, I'm not positive, as you might know for sure. When he died, Louis XIII, you see there under C1A, Richelieu died in 1642, Louis XIII died in 1643. Louis XIII really did not have much of an active reign. When he died, his great-grandson would become Louis XIV. He was 5 years old, and so the same way the cardinal kind of would run the state, Cardinal Mazarin, and he basically continued the policies of Cardinal Richelieu. It went from 1610, it went to being really bad for Protestants to being kind of neutral for Protestants under Richelieu, under Mazarin. But when Mazarin dies, Louis XIV becomes very pro-Catholic. You see, he clashed with the Pope. He tried to make the French church independent from Vatican, but at the same time, he viewed anybody that broke from the French Catholic Church as heretics, and it was not quite as brutal as the Spanish Inquisition, but it was France's own little version of, if you're not Catholic, you're a heretic, and we'll give you a chance to recant, and if you don't, we're going to execute you. It was incredibly vicious, violent persecution within Christianity, Catholics against Protestants. You see on E, 1685, about 90 years after the Edict of Nantes, Louis XIV issued the Edict of Fontainebleau, which abolished the Edict of Nantes. Basically, that's what it did. The religious toleration and freedom that were granted 100 years ago under Henry IV, was it? Yes. Louis XIV did away with. And whenever he did that, that's whenever French Protestants started leaving. They started jumping ship. Yeah.
You know, it really makes you understand why the New World was such a haven.
Yeah.
Because all of these people from the different states of Europe, you know, a lot of them would come over under a leader.
Yeah.
Like the Moravians came into North Carolina and Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And, you know, different, the English groups and the German groups.
Yeah. Yeah, in case you couldn't hear, her comment was that reading about all these struggles really makes it make more sense how the New World was such a haven for religious freedom. And it wasn't the only reason that people came to the New World, but whenever you see 1685 Edict of Fontainebleau, if you're Protestant and you live in France, you're no longer allowed here unless you turn back to Catholicism. Where are people going to go? You can go to Germany, but it's not any better there. You know, you can go to Spain, but, well, they're a Catholic. Yeah, if you're Protestant, you're certainly not going to find a home there. It makes perfect sense why freedom of religion was such a draw. And in the 1500s, 1600s, you know, prior to the United States becoming its own country, it was a land full of opportunity, land of freedom. So, I mentioned to you, you know, my mother's family immigrated to the U.S. 1600s. And so, and once they were here, were practicing as Protestants, as Baptists, most likely were Huguenots. If you have any French ancestry at all, and your family came over here prior to the U.S. becoming its own country, 1600s or so, chances are they were victims of religious persecution and came here at least in part for those reasons. If your family was German and had some, you know, and came around that same time period, my dad's family fled Germany in the 1700s because of much of the same. They were Anabaptists or Moravians, but they fled Germany and went to Russia because of the same Catholic, Protestant, Christian infighting. And, you know, it's something to think about, especially if in your family, if you have whatever your Protestant background is, if it's Protestant, Presbyterian, Methodist, Lutheran, you know, you go back far enough, chances are, you know, in those two centuries, people were coming to the U.S., not exclusively, but in large part, because there was infighting within the Christian church in their own country, and they were looking for a place of religious toleration and freedom, so... Well, Louisiana is Catholic, yeah, because of the French influx. Spain, of course, you know, has its influence in the U.S. as well. And so those two, the French and the Spanish, brought Catholicism here, but it didn't have quite the political power behind it here that it did in Europe. But I mean, if you guys remember, this might have been towards the end of last semester, we talked about some of those Catholic expansions into South America, and it's much the same. It's stories of slavery and abuse and neglect, and intermingled in there are stories of incredible compassion and service and love and kindness. But in South America, there was nobody there to check the spread of Catholicism, whereas here in the U.S. there was. And even today, the lion's share of Central America, South America, even Mexico, are Catholic or Catholic influenced. I'm sorry?
Who was in Israel at this time? What happened to the Christian there?
In Israel, I think the Ottomans had taken over. The Ottomans, the Turks, had taken Constantinople, had pressed as far as Vienna, and then were turned back at Vienna. And so that's kind of where the spread of the Turkish armies would have kept coming, but at Austria they were rebuffed and ended up staying in Turkey. But in Israel, I don't know, Ricky. Yeah, I'm not sure. There probably were. There consistently have been, but I would say, if so, a very small group. Yeah. The notes go on with England. Of course, if you were here a couple of weeks ago, Garrett talked a lot about Reformation in England, both in the 16th century and 17th centuries. And much like the others, it was very, very political, but the Catholic Church didn't have quite as big of an influence in England, which allowed the English government to totally break away and create the Church of England, its own state church. The Church of England still is the state church today. It was it's considered evangelical or Protestant, but formal in a lot of ways. And so England was kind of its own little story. Each country, they're all woven together, but they all have their own little dramas playing out. In the next couple of weeks, what we're going to see is, as these traditions begin to grow, to plant themselves and grow, what each one of them is going to do is they're going to feel the need to really identify their theology and how their theology is separate from one another. And then those theological positions are going to become very dogmatic for Lutherans, Catholics, Reformed Church. By the way, this century, the 1600s, 17th century, you're going to start getting the early runners of human naturalism, scientific movement, and as we begin learning more about the world and things in it, people are going to start looking at faith in light of human reason and balancing the two, questioning the two. Do we really need the scriptures or Christian theology to answer questions for us whenever our scientific, rational mind can give us answers that we need? And so in light of the encroachment of rationalism, the different camps set up within Christian tradition, orthodoxies are going to become very important. And with orthodox thinking, with us saying this is what it means to be orthodox Catholic, this is what it means to be orthodox Lutheran, when you start putting up those walls of orthodoxy, not very far past that, the churches are going to start losing a little bit of their love, compassion, and faith, and they're going to start gaining a whole lot more of adherence to dogma, adherence to orthodoxy, make sure we defend the walls and defend our territory. And so it's interesting to see the big moving waves taking place, but now that Lutherans and Reformed have entrenched themselves, Now they've all got their own territory. Spiritually speaking, it goes back to Nehemiah, where Nehemiah comes back and builds the wall, and Ezra, and Nehemiah builds the physical wall around Jerusalem, but Ezra basically builds a spiritual wall around the Israelite people and says, send your foreign wives away, divorce them and send them back home, reinstitute all the laws, we're going to follow it to the T, we're going to be as dogmatic with the law of Moses as we can be. Now that we have different camps within the Christian church in Europe, they're all going to start building their spiritual walls that identify us and keep us separate from you, and that keeps you separate from somebody else. And then once we have those walls in place, we feel very, very obligated to defend them at all costs. And so this season of fighting, gaining territory, will give way to orthodox thinking and theology, and that will give way to dogma, dogmatic practice in all of these traditions. That's the flow that we see in the 1600s moving forward. And you know, when you think about denominational religion today, I mean, we're always in some place of trying to build up walls or tear down walls between ourselves and between other Christians that have just a different denominational name than we do. But that's something that the Christian church has been doing for over 300 years. So
where's the balance of that?
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a difference in when I think of dogma, Rusty, what I think of is adherence to systems and to tradition. Yeah. And I can think the same, I can have the same theology, but my primary commitment is to love and compassion, to the ministry of the gospel, to following the path of Jesus, and have the exact same theology as someone else, but their primary concern is defending the Baptist way from anybody else's way. It may be one more of motive than it is theology, but in the end, if this is Paul and Barnabas going separate ways, this is the disciples in Jerusalem saying, well, we're not entirely on the same page, but we'll agree that Gentiles don't have to be circumcised in order to be identified as Christians. Even in the early church, this is Paul writing to Corinth saying, why are some of you saying I was baptized by Apollos, and some saying I was baptized by Peter, and some saying I was baptized by Paul? He says, why are you dividing up into these different categories? And when Paul says that in 1 Corinthians, part of me wonders what he would say to the church today that's identified by Martin Luther, that's identified by John Calvin, that's identified by John Wesley, that's identified by St. Augustine, that's identified by St. Francis. It's funny how we read him in Corinth and just think Apollos, Peter, and Paul just applies to those three and doesn't apply to all the other ways we've said, oh, we follow this guy's theology, we follow this guy's theology, we follow this guy's theology. He said that we're all baptized into Christ, and therefore we should all do our best to follow him and serve his example and his ministry. Yes, sir.
Wasn't there a movement in the last century to have a universal Christian church?
Yeah. Well, there have been lots of movements. And kind of in our country, when you see a non-denominational church, that's a little bit of a wink and a nod saying that, yes, we want to kind of get away from that a little bit. But a lot of non-denominational churches still are born out of Baptist church, Anglican church, Methodist church. But, just here in our own community. I mean, churches, Sagemont is on the Beltway, and it doesn't identify in its title a denominational affiliation, but it's very clearly a Baptist church. Gateway Community Church on Clear Lake City Boulevard is a Methodist church. At least its support and its identity is there, but it's not identified in the title. Clear Creek Community Church was born out of Baptist churches cooperating to plant a church. And so you see some churches identify as non-denominational. Some churches just don't put the denomination in their name. Some churches will identify themselves as interdenominational. They're not pretending we don't have denominations. They're just saying we're a church where many denominations can come and work together. And then the word that I use sometimes to talk about our makeup is the word ecumenical. And that's ultimately what the word ecumenical means, is all traditions together. And you don't see too many churches self-identify as an ecumenical church, but every now and then you will see it. But that's the gist of what they're trying. There is, and Unitarian churches are, you know, trying to do the same, even pushing beyond the boundaries of Orthodox Christianity. And so, yeah, there's a lot of recognition that this is not ideal, but we've built this for so many years, we're probably not going to undo it in our lifetime anyways.
Yeah. Christian church, yeah. Not just that we have some names and whatever.
Yeah.
Did that never happen?
It may. Yeah. We need our history, church history guy here. I don't know of it. Yeah. And so, but I'll do some research and see if I can find, yeah, some kind of a treaty or a council or some kind, perhaps. I say a treaty, a council or a.
We're trying to bring, yeah, Baptist and Lutheran and Methodist into,
yeah. Yeah, just a general Protestant church or evangelical church. You know, we get away, Protestant is historically the tag that's used for a lot of these denominations, but you hear within Protestant the word protest. I mean, they were the churches that were protesting what was going on in the Catholic Church. And so as we move forward, our identity really isn't so much that we're protesting anything. You know, we're not protesting anything anymore. And so in some cases, you see the word evangelical tied to those churches instead. But that's assuming that the Catholic Church doesn't evangelize or share the gospel or tell other people, you know, about Jesus, which is not entirely true either. And so I don't know what the best word would be, you know, to speak about Protestant churches today or evangelical churches today. But usually when you hear evangelical, that's kind of a substituted word for Protestant that's a little bit more comfortable into where we are today. We moved into the 1600s, and so we'll continue there. We're going to talk more about these Orthodox theologies, the Council of Trent, and some of the Catholic, Reformed, Lutheran ways of practicing theology and orthodoxy in 2 weeks. Next week, we've got a special guest, a friend of Aaron Glenn's is going to come. A lot of our conversation has been about Christianity and its development within Europe. That's because we know a lot about it. But Christianity was developing in other parts of the world as well. I mean, it had spread into Africa, into India, into the Far East. And so they're going to come and talk about some of the development of Christianity in India and South Asia, and then some of the trends with the Christian church in South Asia today. It should be of particular interest to all of us because in our part of Houston, there are a lot of folks living and working with our church members that are from Pakistan, from India, Bangladesh, other South Asian countries. And so I encourage you to come. It will not be, I'll be here, Garrett will be here, but we're going to let them kind of share from their expertise about what Christianity in India and South Asia look like historically and also today. So then in 2 weeks, we'll return back to some of these Orthodox theologies of the 17th century.